Assalamu alaikum. Welcome back to the Islamic History Podcast. This will be a bonus episode. So, lots to talk about today. First, I would like to explain why am I doing this? Why am I suddenly putting out this bonus episode for the Islamic History Podcast? Well, essentially, my laptop died on me. Normally, after I finish the regular season of the Islamic History Podcast, I try to work on the premium episodes for those who are subscribed to Islamic History Exclusive. And I was doing that. And we're on the 8th episode of the 3rd season of the Umayyad Caliphate. But my laptop died on me suddenly a couple of days ago. And right now I cannot work on that series because it's just the way that things are set up with that podcast. I just can't do it right now. I could do it because I have a backup computer. But it will take so much work to get the data and my research transferred from online accounts and my hard drives, external hard drives and everything to my Windows computer or my other computer, my backup computer. It will just take a lot of work. My laptop should be coming back by the end of this week, inshallah. And then I will go ahead and resume the Umayyad Caliphate. I'm about halfway through this season of the Umayyad Caliphate. Roughly, I plan for it to be about 16 episodes. I think I'm on episode 8 right now. I just finished episode 8 a couple of days ago or last week or so. So hopefully we can get back to that soon for those of you who are subscribed to the Islamic History Exclusive part of this podcast. Now, this episode is something that I've been working on for a while. See, essentially, I've been working on two bonus series ever since the end of season 9, which was the second season of the Mughal Empire. I've been working on two different topics that I found very interesting, and I hope to complete them soon. I don't know when, inshallah, but I've been working on two of them. Number one is what this one is going to be about, the special relationship, and that is a special relationship between the United States and Israel. And the second topic that I am researching currently and will hopefully bring to you sometime soon, I have no idea when, is the history of the Quran. I find that a very interesting topic, one that I think is very important for Muslims to know, and generally for anybody, even if you're not Muslim, I think it's important for you to at least understand the history of the Quran and why Muslims make the claims for the Quran that we make, and also the proof of those claims. I won't say too much about that because I'm still doing the research on that. This special relationship one is going to be really about the relationship between the United States and Israel. And that's pretty obvious, but there's still more to talk about before we actually get into that idea. Now, the origin of this idea, that is the special relationship, this episode right here. This, as I mentioned, will hopefully be the first in a series about the history of the U.S.-Israel relationship. Most of this is inspired by a book called The Israel Lobby by John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt. And this book does, admittedly, I admit that it comprises the bulk of my research, but I am also using previous research from season 6 of the Islamic History Podcast and various academic articles, but much of what I'm going to share with you is really inspired by the book, The Israel Lobby. So definitely, I would actually have to say that the current, I don't want to use the word war, people get upset about using the word conflict, but the violence that Israel is inflicting against the Palestinians of Gaza currently right now as of April 2024, that is definitely the root of much of the inspiration for me wanting to do this series. Now let me give you some more information about the primary author of this book, The Israel Lobby, that is John Mearsheimer. These two authors are not anti-Israel. They both believe in Israel's right to exist. However, because they are more pro-America, they believe that the United States' special relationship, and I put that in quotes, special relationship with Israel is actually detrimental to the United States. So if you do choose to go and read this book after this episode, or for whatever reason, don't expect their findings to completely align with Islamic principles. Because again, they're not Muslim, nor are they anti-Israel, but they do give a very even-handed analysis of this relationship between the United States and Israel, and they are much more even-handed and give a much more, 365 view of the situation than most quote-unquote or so-called experts of the Palestine-Israel conflict. And in my opinion, it appears that the authors more or less support a two-state solution, even though they don't believe that, it doesn't appear that they believe that that is possible. Now, speaking of the two-state solution, I'm going to go off on a little tangent here, but I will get back to the main topic soon, inshallah. There are various proposed solutions, potential solutions to the ongoing conflict between Israel and Palestine. I know some people don't like the word conflict, but it's difficult for me to try to find another word. It's not really a war. Yes, right now you can call this current campaign a genocide, but as we all know, this didn't start on October 7th. So this started over 100 years ago. So it's really hard to really use another word besides conflict. So if you don't like that word, I'm sorry. I'm not doing it because I'm trying to minimize it or minimize the Palestinian situation at all, but it's just difficult to find another appropriate word, especially when you're kind of talking off the cuff. Anyway, there are various proposed solutions to the conflict. There is, of course, the famous two-state solution. That is one state for Israel and a second independent state for Palestine. There is another potential solution or proposed solution called the one-state solution. This is where Palestinians become Israeli citizens and Israel must, by default, abandon the idea of a Jewish state. That's the one-state solution. Then there is this new thing that Benjamin Netanyahu came up with called, I don't know what it's called, I'm just going to call it Netanyahu's solution. And this is, at least what he has said publicly. I'm not talking about what he really means in his heart, because quite frankly, I think he wants to annihilate the Palestinians. But at least what he has said publicly is he wants to rebuild Gaza along the same lines that the Allied forces rebuilt Japan and Germany after World War II. And then there's, of course, the status quo. That means basically keeping things the way they currently are, or at least they were the way they were on October 6th. This is where Palestine is supposedly an autonomous territory that is nominally governed by the Palestinian Authority, or the PA. But this territory, this so-called autonomous territory, because it's not really autonomous, this autonomous territory is still beholden and completely dependent on Israel. So Palestinians do not have a true state, but the PA's authority, the Palestinian Authority's authority, and is recognized globally. So that means maintaining the status quo. Now, here are the problems with these four solutions. That's a two-state solution, one-state solution, Netanyahu solution, and the status quo. The problem with the two-state solution, first of all, many Muslims believe this is haram. I'm not going to chime in whether I believe it's haram or not. I'm just going to say that many Muslims believe that this is haram. If you go to listen to a recent episode I did with the Muslim podcaster, my brother Majid Hossein, we discussed the Islamic and the whole ramifications of the two-state solution. And they're not everything, but we discussed it in depth. And we had some differences of opinions on it, but I can suggest you go listen to that for a rigorous debate back and forth regarding the two-state solution and how it could or could not be implemented. Now, my take on, well, before I even get to my take, I want to also say that those Muslims who believe that a two-state solution is haram, as I mentioned, they say that this recognizes and legitimizes Israel, and they also say that it is not permissible, it is haram, forbidden by Allah to give up any land that had been conquered by Muslims. Now, my take on this is that I'm not qualified to speak on whether this is permissible in Islam or not. I'm not a scholar. I haven't really done any research on whether it is permissible or not in Islamically. I can say that historically, Salah al-Din al-Ayyubi did conclude a peace treaty with the Crusaders, recognizing their control of certain parts of Palestine. Not Jerusalem, but certain parts of Palestine along the coast that the Crusaders still held on to after the primary conflict for Jerusalem had been settled. Now, this treaty, of course, so this peace treaty was overturned later by later groups. I don't really know whether it was overturned or whether it was abolished because one side or the other violated the terms of the treaty. But eventually, the Mamluks drove the Crusaders out of Palestine after Salah al-Din's empire fell apart. But at the same time, Salah al-Din is not the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. Salah al-Din was not a Sahaba, so some people could say that Salah al-Din could have concluded his peace treaty, but he may have been in violation. I mean, he's not a Sahaba. He doesn't have the same authority that we would give to a Sahaba who had done something like this. So that's one thing. But I can say that Salah al-Din al-Ayyubi did conclude a peace treaty with the Crusaders, recognizing their control of some of the coastal cities in Palestine. Now, my take is that whether it is permissible or not, it is moot, because I don't really believe a two-state solution will ever happen. Israel has had many opportunities to establish a two-state solution, but they have always balked, always found some reason to never implement it. Furthermore, the current government and most previous Israeli governments have adamantly rejected the idea of a two-state solution. They have unequivocally said they will not allow this to happen. So there's that. But even if somehow some liberal-leaning government came into power in Israel, even if that were to happen, there was some Israeli government that was willing to push it forward, it's nearly impossible to implement a two-state solution now, not a true two-state solution. For one thing, there is the actual physical reality that Gaza and the West Bank are separated by about 25 miles of open desert. All right. So I just don't think it's possible to successfully govern an independent nation in such a fashion. Secondly, and this is probably perhaps even more important, the settlements in the West Bank that are there, the Jewish settlements in the West Bank, they cannot remain if Palestine is truly supposed to be an independent state. There's no way an independent state can function with multiple pockets of heavily armed, hostile non-citizens living there. All right, that just cannot happen. And some of these settlements can be dismantled, but they can only be dismantled by force, because some of these settlements are very, very large. They're like small cities now. So if you're going to dismantle them, they have to be dismantled by force, because the settlers that are there, or the colonizers, probably a better phrase, the colonizers that are there are not willing to leave. They're not going to leave just because their government says it's time for you to leave. They're not going to. We saw what happened in Gaza back in 2006, I believe. All right, so that's a two-state solution. I honestly don't believe the two-state solution is possible. Now, the one-state solution. First of all, that's one where the Israel recognizes Palestinians as Israeli citizens and gives them full rights as equal citizens. Now, first of all, that's never going to happen, right? Israel will never do that for two primary reasons. They're going to use security as an excuse, which may be a legitimate excuse, but that's one thing. Secondly, Israel would eventually lose its Jewish identity. That if Israel acknowledged all the Palestinians that currently live in Palestine right now, not to mention those who have throughout the Palestinian diaspora, just those who live in Palestine right now, Israel would eventually lose its Jewish identity. In order for Israel to overcome this eventuality, it will have to retain its current apartheid policies. In order for Israel to maintain a Jewish state, to remain a Jewish state, if it decides to use a one-state solution, it will have to retain its current apartheid policies. There's no other way it can happen. This means that they will have to force the Palestinians to be citizens, but they'll be second-class citizens. They will have to force Palestinians to live in certain areas, and there will have to be regular violence against the Palestinians to keep them in their place. So is that true citizenship? That's what Israel would have to do if they were going to try to maintain its Jewish identity and supposedly make Palestinians equal citizens. So it just, to me, it's a non-starter. It's just never going to happen. Now, let's say in some strange reality, Israel was to go along with this one-state solution and actually treat Palestinians like true equal citizens, well, Israel would disappear within a few decades. Palestinians simply have more children. And as they have more children, those children will grow. They will eventually begin to equal and even outnumber Israel's Jewish citizens. And those Palestinians who are citizens now would demand a greater say in the government. And since, as everybody says, Israel is the only democratic nation in the Middle East, democratic principles would eventually allow the Palestinians to take over that country. The one-state solution, I do not believe Israel will ever allow. Just like it's not going to allow the two-state solution. And then we get to Netanyahu's ridiculous solution. This is probably the dumbest idea of all. First of all, Netanyahu's political career is probably over after the current genocide campaign ends. Netanyahu's political career is probably going to be over. Second, there are some fundamental differences between Palestine now and Japan and Germany after World War II. So that's his grand plan, to reshape Palestine and the thinking of Palestine and the culture of the Palestinians, similar to the way the Allied forces reshaped Japan and Germany after their defeat in World War II. But there are some fundamental differences between these two entities, between Palestine and Japan and Germany. First of all, Germany and Japan both accepted responsibility for World War II and their actions during that war. Palestinians now and those who support them, first of all, not even that Palestinians don't feel that they are responsible, Palestinians are not responsible for the current genocidal campaign. Palestinians are not responsible for 30,000 plus 40,000 of their own people being killed by Israel's bombs. That's ridiculous. Okay, Palestinians are not responsible for that. They don't feel responsible for it. And so there's no way that they are going to have any sort of remorse after all is said and done. That's crazy. Germany and Japan felt remorse for their actions because they did some really crazy evil stuff during the war. And they did essentially start the war. Whether it was Germany invading Poland or Japan attacking Pearl Harbor, they started the war. Palestine did not. Gaza did not. Secondly, along with those same lines, the Palestinians are not responsible for Israel's ongoing occupation and oppression. Only Israel, and to a certain extent, America, United States as well, but Israel predominantly is responsible for that, not the Palestinians. So that's the first reason. Germany and Japan felt responsible for World War II, whereas the Palestinians are not responsible and do not feel responsible, so they will not willingly change their culture to fit Israel's whims. Second reason, Germany and Japan both had recognized governments that willingly submitted to Allied demands. Gaza in particular does not have a recognized government. It had Hamas, but Hamas is somewhat decimated by now and is not a recognized government. You do have the Palestinian Authority. The Palestinian Authority has long since submitted to Israel's demands, but the West Bank has not benefited from it. Nothing has changed as far as Palestinians in the West Bank. Yes, their life is better than those of in Gaza, but they are still not even like second class citizens. They are treated like Allah knows. I can't say. All right. We've seen the polls. Like since the beginning of the year, like 84 Palestinian children in the West Bank, where there is no Hamas, have been killed by Israeli policemen. Do you know the kind of uproar there would be in the United States if 84 black kids were killed by policemen here, or in any one single state? There would be so much uproar, but 84 kids have been killed. 80 something kids. I'm not sure the exact numbers. There certainly has gone up by now. Nearly 100 children, minors, have been killed by Israeli forces, Israeli policemen, whatever, in the West Bank. So this is to show that even though the Palestinian Authority has recognized Israel's right to exist, it follows all the rules that the Israel, the United States, Nine Nations gives them. Palestinian Authority follows all of those rules, and they are still treated like trash. This goes to show that simply obeying the rules is not going to do anything better for the Palestinians. So when I say rules, I mean that in quotation marks, I'm talking about the edicts, the demands of the current world order. Those are two things, two reasons why Netanyahu's stupid idea is not going to work. The final one is that Germany and Japan, before World War II, both had distinct warrior cultures. Warrior cultures that were distinct to those lands. Japan, before it modernized, I forgot the Meiji Restoration, I forgot the name of the period of time where Japan modernized after it was forced to open itself up to the West. Japan eventually left the Bushido Code, its feudal society with samurais and all that kind of stuff. It eventually left that and came into the modern era as far as military is concerned. But even so, that warrior culture was there up until it was defeated in World War II. Japan had a unique warrior culture. Even in World War II, Japan's officers, naval and army officers, carried samurai swords, katana blades. Okay, that was part of their culture. They just morphed the Bushido Code and its culture to fit modern technology. Modern for World War II, that is, of course. Germany was also a warrior nation that had a warrior culture. But after it was defeated, both of these nations were defanged. I don't know how to put it. They were defanged. They were neutered to remove that warrior culture that they used to have. And in some way, some of that had to be taken away because both nations did some crazy stuff in World War II. But Palestine is not in that situation. Yes, Palestine does have a distinct culture. And I will say that Palestine actually has a warrior culture also, a warrior mentality. But this warrior mentality of the Palestinians is not influenced because they're Palestinian. It is mostly influenced by Islamic principles. By Islamic principles and to a lesser extent, Arab culture. Arabs have long had a warrior culture. Even before Islam, they had a warrior culture. And they just carried on into Islam when Islam came. But the Palestinians' warrior culture, to me, feel free to disagree with me, but I believe that Palestine's warrior culture is more or less due to its influence from Islamic principles, more so than Palestinian culture, but even Arab culture as well. Nearly every single Islamic culture, every single Islamic group, people, nation, most of them have a certain warrior element to it, because this is, some people may not, I know people are scared to say the word jihad these days, but this was part of Islam's origin. The willingness and the necessity to sacrifice your life for the greater good. And that is sacrificing your life to establish Islam or to protect Islam and to defend Islam. So this warrior mentality is part of Islam's DNA, in my opinion. Feel free to disagree. And most Muslim cultures around the world, whether it was in India, in the Balkans, in Anatolia, in Africa, in the Middle East, in Arabia, almost all of them have a certain militant, maybe not warrior, maybe a militant, background in a way, a militant element to it. And that has not gone away. All right, so all of that is to say that Netanyahu is not going to be able to remove that because he pummels Gaza into dust. He's not going to be able to do that. It's not going to happen. It's a stupid idea. It's ridiculous. And he's a fool for even thinking like that. All right, and then finally, there's a status quo. Now, this is a final solution. Maybe that's the wrong phrase. The last solution of the four solutions I mentioned was, of course, to maintain the status quo. But most people are aware that things are not going to go back to the way they were before October 7th. The pre-October 7th status quo, we all recognize, is untenable. There has been a fundamental shift in the global perception of Israel, the West, and the United States. Now, I don't know how things are going to happen or what is going to happen next, because like every single day or every single week, there's something new. Just yesterday, I'm recording this day after Iran launched its airstrikes against Israel. Now, they didn't do anything, but who knows what's going to come next? The airstrikes, you know what I'm talking about. Israel attacked Iran's embassy in Syria. And in retaliation, Iran launched a bunch of drones and missiles, but most of them Israel shot down. A few landed on one of his air bases, but I don't think they did any damage. Now, who knows if Israel is going to retaliate against that retaliation and escalate things even further? Who knows? So I'm going to acknowledge that I have no idea what's going to happen next. But we all have to acknowledge that we are watching history unfold. This situation is not over yet and will not end just because Israel decides to finally stop killing people. It's not going to end. So that's the lie, the fairy tale that Israel told itself before October 7th. They felt that because they thought they had the Palestinians contained and they thought they had the Abraham Accords giving them all these new Muslim friends around the world, they thought everything had been taken care of, that they had won. As you can see, things could change very quickly in this world. Allah knows best. Another thing is that Israel's savagery and brutality during these past six, 7 months of genocidal behavior, this has all been recorded for posterity. Israel can no longer control the narrative as they have been able to do for decades now. It's all out there now. Modern technology, the internet, drone cameras, cell phones, all of these things, social media, have captured this information and have recorded it. And now we will be able to see this for years and years to come, inshallah. So now that leads to this special relationship. For decades, Israel and its supporters in the West have been able to control the narrative, like I just said. The special relationship between the United States and most of the West, but we're really talking about the United States right now, the special relationship between the United States and Israel has allowed this false narrative to exist for so long. But modern technology and social media has forced the world to see beyond this false narrative. So that's what we're really going to talk about in this episode, inshallah. We're going to discuss the history of this quote-unquote special relationship between the United States and Israel and whether it's even beneficial to the United States. So now let's ask ourselves, what is the special relationship? I boil the special relationship to three things. Number one, the United States provides military and financial aid to Israel, which allows Israel to maintain a quote-unquote qualitative military advantage over other nations in the Middle East. That's one principle of the U.S.'s special relationship. The second principle is that the United States will use its veto power on the U.N. Security Council to protect Israel from international criticism, sanctions, and any sort of punitive measures. And the final element of the special relationship between the U.S. and Israel is extensive political, military, economic, and diplomatic cooperation between the U.S. and Israel. Those, to me, are the three legs to the stool of the special relationship between the U.S. and Israel. There are other things to it that you may want to add. That's up to you. That's what I see as the foundation of the special relationship between the U.S. and Israel. Now, when did this special relationship begin? Let's talk about some of the origins. First of all, before World War II, most American politicians were in agreement and voiced at least nominal support for a Jewish state in Palestine. And we discussed this briefly in both season 5 and season 6. I don't remember the exact episodes, but we did discuss them in both of those episodes. I'm sorry, both of those seasons. Now, the United States was the first nation to recognize the State of Israel in 1948, but this was mostly done for political reasons. The United States then and now had a large, wealthy, and influential Jewish population. Whereas back then, in 1948, things are a little bit different now, but back then, the United States did not have a significant Arab nor a significant Muslim population. Even now, where the numbers of the Arab and Muslim population is getting close to the numbers of the Jewish population in the United States, it still is not close to that, to those numbers, and it definitely doesn't have the influence that the Jewish population has in the United States. Nonetheless, even though the United States did recognize the State of Israel in 1948, the United States didn't rush to support Israel either diplomatically or militarily. For one thing, the United States really did not want to upset the newly independent Arab nations in the Middle East. They believed that if the United States believed that if it went too hard in the paint on behalf of Israel, then this would push the Arab states in the region in the Middle East into the Soviet camp. So actually, in the early days, the United States gave very little military assistance to Israel. This is a common misconception that a lot of, unfortunately, Muslims have. Many Muslims believe that the United States supported Israel militarily in the 1948 Arab-Israel War, but that is simply just not true. The United States didn't take any, at least publicly, did not take any sides and didn't offer any military assistance to either side. Israel won that war, and we covered this back in Season 6, by the way, but in my opinion, Israel won that war for four reasons. Number one, the Arab states were not united. They just were not. They had a common purpose, but they didn't have like a single military command. Each military was acting kind of independently. That's the second reason. Each state operated independently during the war, and there's very little cohesion. Those are two reasons. The Arab states individually were not united. The second reason was that their militaries were not operating together either. A third reason, a major reason, was that Egypt, the most powerful Arab nation in that war, Egypt's king did not support the war. So because he didn't support the war, Egypt's military was hindered and couldn't really do as well as it could have done had it received more support from the king. And finally, the Israeli forces had more military experience. Simply put, many of the Israeli forces had worked with the British before that. They had been trained by the British. They had been committing terrorism against the Palestinians and the British, for that matter, for years before that. And so they had more military experience. So even after the war was over, the United States still refused to even sell weapons to Israel in these early years of its establishment. So this is just giving you the idea that I just want you to understand that in the beginning, the United States was not just handing Israel billions of dollars in weapons from the very beginning. It just wasn't the case. But things began to change with the Kennedy administration. JFK. John F. Kennedy was the first American president to authorize a major sale of U.S. weapons. This took place in 1963. U.S. weapons to Israel, that is. These were Hawk anti-aircraft missiles. And far as I can tell, JFK was also the first president to use the phrase, quote-unquote, special relationship. He used this phrase during a meeting with, at that point in time, Israel's foreign minister, Golda Meir. So in 1963, the United States sold a bunch of anti-aircraft missiles to Israel. The following year, the United States sold 200 tanks to Israel. This took place in 1964. Now, these weapon sales to Israel were mostly to counterbalance Gamal Abdel Nasser, the president of Egypt, Gamal Abdel Nasser's growing relationship with the Soviet Union. He had recently purchased a bunch of weapons from the Soviets. The United States sold these weapons to Israel to balance Israel's military edge against the Arab states, but also the United States wanted to encourage Israel to abandon its pursuit of nuclear weapons. Israel wanted to acquire nuclear weapons because it believed it faced an existential threat. Well, we see how well that plan worked out, because Israel still got nuclear weapons, even with all the weapons that the United States was selling to them. So this was just the beginning. But things really began to change in 1967 with the Six-Day War. Before 1967, most American aid to Israel averaged about $63 million a year, and it was mostly just economic and food. Economic aid and food aid. It wasn't really weapons. It wasn't really military aid. But in 1967, the United States started pumping more military aid into Israel. And by 1971, American aid to Israel had increased to $634 million a year. That's like 10 times over. Before that, it was $63 million a year. In 1971, 4 years later, $634 million a year. And most of this was military aid. It had gone from mostly economic and food aid, basically money and food, to now weapons. And that amount continued to increase. It got even higher after the Yom Kippur, or sometimes called the Ramadan War, or the October War that took place in 1973. So it continued to increase after that war. We're going to talk more about that war later on, inshallah. So by 1976, Israel had become the largest recipient of U.S. foreign aid, and it remains number one in that spot even till today. And today, most of this aid, back then and now, by the way, most of that aid is military aid. Now, here's something that's interesting. Most of this military aid to Israel actually comes in the forms of loans instead of grants. See, a grant, basically, you don't have to pay back. A loan, you do have to pay back with interest. Of course, we're not talking about Islamic principles here, so don't get on me about riba, but we're talking about just how these Western states are operating. Anyway, however, interestingly, if the United States were to give military grants to Israel, the laws in the United States would require U.S. military oversight, and Israel does not want that. So instead, Israel requests this foreign aid in the form of loans. But here's the kicker. These loans are always waived, and there's no interest on them. So the loans are waived, so they don't have to pay them back. There's no interest on them. So it's really just changing the terminology from grant to loan. And so they're basically grants anyway. Right now, in the late 1990s, the United States began to phase out its direct financial aid to Israel. But while it began to decrease how much plain old money was given to Israel, it began to increase its military aid. So today, the United States provides over $3 billion in foreign aid to Israel. Listen to this quote. This is coming from the U.S. State Department's website. I'm not making this up. It's not from some researcher. This is from the United States Department, the U.S. State Department website. Quote, "The United States provides $3.3 billion annually in foreign military financing and an additional $500 million in missile defense funding. Missile defense funding supports several cooperative missile defense programs, including David Sling and Iron Dome, as well as Arrow, Arrow 2, and Arrow 3, whose life-saving capabilities have proved vital to Israel's security. In 2022, the United States provided $1 billion in supplemental funding to replenish Israel's stock of missile interceptors for the Iron Dome." Unquote. So this is coming from the United States itself. Now, this assistance that the United States is currently giving to Israel, $3.3 billion at least in 2022, this accounts for about 2% of Israel's GDP. This means that if this was broken down into cash, every single Israeli citizen would be getting $500 per year from the United States. The U.S. government doesn't even give its own citizens $500 a year. You got to be super poor to get any money from the United States or some other reason. The United States just give its own citizens $500 a year, but it's doing that for Israel. But there's more to it than that. In 1998, the United States gave Israel $1.2 billion to help it implement the Y River Memorandum. We discussed the Y River Memorandum in season 6 of the Islamic History Podcast, but I'm not going to recap it, but basically it was it was an agreement to basically resume Oslo II, which was one of the many accords between Israel and the Palestinian Authority during the 1990s. So the United States gave Israel $1.2 billion to help convince it, to help it move forward with the Y River Memorandum. But here's the kicker. Netanyahu was prime minister at the time. He signed off on the deal, the Y River Memorandum, but later in the year, he abandoned it. And guess what? He did not have to pay that money back. That $1.2 billion that he was supposed to use to help with the Y River Memorandum, he didn't have to pay any of that back, even though he abandoned the deal later on that he signed off on. Him personally, not a previous government, he signed off on it. Another interesting thing is that the United States allows Israel to use a portion of this aid to bolster its own military-industrial complex. Yes, Israel has a military-industrial complex. So as of 2017, Israel was the eighth largest weapons exporter in the world. In addition to this money that Israel gets from the United States government, which of course is coming from the taxpayers, it also receives billions of dollars from U.S. citizens. Not as taxes, not as this foreign aid, just plain old money from U.S. citizens. It does this by U.S. citizens purchasing Israeli government bonds. That's basically how it does it. Wealthy American citizens purchase millions, even billions of dollars in Israeli bonds, Israeli government bonds, which just basically gives that government a whole bunch of low interest money. Additionally, Israel can also, because of its special relationship with the United States, Israel can also borrow money from U.S. banks at very low interest rates. Now, Israel is not the only country that receives military and foreign aid from the United States. The United States also gives billions of dollars to both Egypt and Jordan. But these are essentially bribes for these nations to maintain their diplomatic relations with Israel. We discussed this in season 6. I won't get too deep into it. But basically, the United States basically bribes Egypt and Jordan to remain friends, at least the governments to remain friends with Israel. Egypt gets about $1.4 billion a year, making it the third largest recipient of U.S. foreign aid. This is in 2022 now. Jordan gets about $1.2 billion in U.S. aid, making it the fourth largest recipient as of 2022. Inshallah, I will continue this series because there's a lot more of my research that I've done so far that I want to share with you, but I'm going to have to wrap it up right here. So in the next episode, inshallah, I don't know when it's going to be because I still got the Umayyad Caliphate to do. So it's very difficult for me to work on two projects at once. I'll do my best, inshallah, but I am going to complete this series, inshallah, bi-idhn Allah, by the permission of Allah. My intention is to complete this series. But for now, in the next episode, whenever that comes out, don't know when, I want to talk about how the United States has supported Israel in some of its major conflicts, particularly the Ramadan War of 1973. That's also sometimes called the Yom Kippur War. And I want to talk about it in this episode, but we're pushing too much time right now. I'll have to wait for the next one, inshallah. But also Israel's invasion of Lebanon in 1982 and how that led to the Sabra and Shatila massacres. I want to talk about the United States' support of Israel during those two conflicts. And then I want to get into the why. Why does the United States continue to support Israel? There's lots of reasons why that people have given as to why. My goal is to explain these reasons, discuss them, and see them if they are legitimate, and if they really do benefit the United States. Inshallah, in the next episode, we'll talk about that. But until then, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.